Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Today, we're going to do a deep dive into the smallest neurotransmitter, nitric oxide, composed of one nitrogen atom, one oxygen atom, and one pesky unpaired electron. So not only is nitric oxide a neurotransmitter, it's also a free radical. This means it is highly reactive. It will play ball with anything, and it likes to mess with DNA, cell membranes, and other signals. And of course, by now, if you're a regular listener, you know when you mess up the shape of something by changing its charge, you can set a whole series of chain reactions in action, most of them bad. But nitric oxide is actually a good guy most of the time. I like to think of it as a spark or a match. Sure, it can start a forest fire, and we'll talk about inducible nitric oxide in the setting of infection in just a moment. But it also makes a great signaling device or trigger. You just have to remember to blow it out right away so it doesn't spread. So nitric oxide is found in a number of tissues. It's found in the brain, where it's very important for two things. First of all, blood vessel opening up and sending extra blood when there's a demand for a certain tissue, like hopefully right now. Extra blood's going to your temporal lobe, where you're processing all of this speech into images or whatever else you use in your brain to grok things. And synaptic plasticity, which is what allows our brains. I like to think of every neuron as a squid. It's got a lot of tentacles, and it sends those tentacles out to interact, touch other squid neurons in other neurons. And the brain is just one big cephalopod. And many cephalopods. And those cephalopods are talking to each other. And when you need to make a new memory, form a new thought, learn a new skill, well, you just reach out, build a new tentacle, and send it off in the right direction until it makes contact, and boom, you've got a solid physical change in your brain that leads to memory and learning. But nitric oxide isn't done. It's also extremely important in the genitals. It's responsible for erections. And actually, Viagra and her two friends, Cialis and Levitra, does sound like three girls' names, doesn't it? Well, Viagra and friends need nitric oxide. In fact, that's what they do. If there's no nitric oxide present, then they don't work, because what they do is cause that nitric oxide to hang around just a little bit longer, fanning the spark, so to speak, to get that whole hydraulic process underway. And then, of course, there's inducible nitric oxide. I promised I'd talk about that. That's induced by cytokines, those chemical signals. You'll remember the term cytokine storm from last year. Probably was the word of the year, I think, for 2020. It's part of the inflammatory response, but if you get too many of them, you get something called septic shock, which leads to too much vasodilation. The blood pressure tanks, that's what shock is. And of course, at that point, you stop feeding oxygen and glucose to everything because you no longer have a blood pressure to drive the flow of blood to the organs and through those capillary beds. And the whole system just kind of crumbles. Once it gets rolling, septic shock is really hard to reverse. The healthiest people who come in with septic shock have about a 50% survival rate. It's that bad a thing to get. The last place, and another extremely important place where nitric oxide is critical, is in the lining of the blood vessels, the so-called endothelium, particularly the arteries, where it controls blood pressure by relaxing the blood vessels or allowing them to tighten due to the influence of angiotensin converting enzyme. So angiotensin converting enzyme makes something called angiotensin, which tightens up the angios. See, and you thought that was a fancy name, but actually that's how we remember this stuff. the two types of drugs, angiotensin receptor blockers and angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, lower blood pressure. And that's how that all stacks together. Another thing that also improves the synthesis of nitric oxide and relaxes the blood vessels are, ironically, statins. But nitric oxide can also combine with oxygen-free radicals. This can form a especially toxic substance called peroxynitrate, which can mutate DNA and damage cell membranes and cause accelerated aging. So you've got to be careful with this stuff. Now, nitric oxide is produced in the arteries by turning L-arginine into something else. L-arginine is an amino acid. You actually split off a nitrogen and an oxygen from the L-arginine to create the nitric oxide. And it's very rapidly absorbed from the lining of the blood vessel. It's produced in the lining, and then it's sucked into the muscle layer where it causes the muscle layer to relax. Nitric oxide is also important for platelet aggregation. It's important for the proliferation of smooth muscles. So that's obviously really critical. It, as I said, can form things like superoxides, like that peroxynitrate, and it can oxidize LDL. Well, that's important because oxidized LDL is going to be able to get into the artery, get below that endothelium, and get eaten up by a, well, it's called a mutated macrophage. It's a transformed macrophage, not mutated, but it's now gathering up extra lipid, and that's how plaques get started. So too much nitric oxide, no bueno. Not enough, no bueno. Like many things in the body, it's a delicate balance. So why are we talking about this? Well, for one thing, nitrates and nitric oxide can be elaborated through the diet. And you know I'm all about diet, so I want to talk to you about, would you believe the microbiome comes into this? Well, you probably would if you're a regular listener. The nitrate-nitric oxide pathway goes something like this. We eat nitrate in foods, and some of the higher containing foods are watercress, celery, spinach, beets, and cabbage. So all those vegetables that we keep telling you to eat. Now, while you're chewing them, bacteria in your oral cavity are actually at work transforming the nitrate into nitrite. And by the way, those bacteria are killed by the standard kill the bacteria mouthwashes like Listerine and Scope and all of those. So if you have high blood pressure, first bit of practical advice for tonight's show, stop using mouthwash. You're interfering with the production of a vasodilating neurotransmitter by killing the bacteria that help convert it to nitrite. You also get some conversion in the stomach just by the fact that the stomach's acid, not, of course, if you're taking a daily proton pump inhibitor, and actually not if you're eating on the run and gobbling. So another bit of practical advice. If you want to digest your food properly, and that includes getting enough nitrate out of what you've just eaten, don't eat if your mouth feels dry. Relax. Take a walk. Calm down. Try for some saliva. Maybe smell the food a little bit. Maybe look at it and smell it and think foodie thoughts until your mouth feels moist. That means that the acid in your stomach has also been triggered by your thoughts. And of course, you can notice your saliva. You don't necessarily notice the stomach acid, but the two are released simultaneously when the brain finally gets the idea that you're eating. So talking on your cell phone while driving, while eating, is another no bueno thing if you have directly biochemically, if you have high blood pressure. So stop the mouthwash and pull over and take 5 minutes and smell the food and eat your meal if you must eat in your car. But you really want to give food your undivided attention if that's at all possible. Well, all that nitrate and the nitrite are absorbed in the intestine. The nitrate go from the gut in the bloodstream where they are activated by nitric oxide synthetase. And you actually get the whole process looping. So the extra nitrite that isn't used, that goes off to the kidneys, where it's released as something you may have heard of, blood urea nitrogen. When you eat a high nitrogen diet, like lots of amino acids, that goes up. When you eat a low one, well, that goes down. So you want to eat your protein, you want to keep your carbs down, and you want to eat those high nitrate vegetables if you've got high blood pressure. We're now going to move on to our next topic, which is another geeky topic a little bit, but also I think near and dear to our hearts and our amygdalas, because I'm scared of a traumatic brain injury. And if you're not, you probably should be. We know from research in lately, that's been a big movement in football players and soccer players. And I think I commented the other day, although I think it was in a, I don't, wasn't on this podcast, but it got a laugh from the group of doctors in the discussion. We were discussing how the brain injury occurs and how it accumulates. And football is one of the big problems for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. The brain is injured and scarred up, and you can look at those brains of pro football players and actually see these changes. They're quite visible, and you can also pick them up with certain kinds of staining on MRI. But I joked to people that the state in the nation that is the most avid for football and starts their kids out in contact football in grade school is Texas, and possibly the high frequency of undiagnosed chronic traumatic encephalopathy in Texas explains some of their behavior. Traumatic brain injury. Now, back 30 years ago in medical school, I was taught that what happens, because we knew this, we knew that if you got hit in the front of the head, the damage to the brain was worse on the back of the head. And that didn't really make a whole lot of sense, but they told us it was kind of like whiplash. So the idea was you're running along with the ball and someone bashes right into you head to head with the helmet. Okay, your head stops moving right away, but your brain continues to move forward. And the idea was the brain bounced off the front, off the inside of the skull, and then slapped the back of the skull hard. And it was the stretching and the swat to the back of the brain that caused there to be more injury on the opposite side of the impact. But that actually isn't what's going on. And it never, if you really stop and think about it, it doesn't really make sense. It's a flexible, rubbery object. The force of the blow is actually going to have attenuated, and a lot of it's going to have been absorbed by the impact on the front of the skull. So it doesn't necessarily make sense. Then version 2.0 of this explanation was, oh, it's the stretching of the tissue. You know what? You just kind of say, yes, teacher, and let's move on to the next thing you have to memorize for the test. But actually, this phenomenon called the contre-coup injury or the opposite hit injury is not stretch. It's not swelling. A new theory has emerged that it's an actual explosive force that's generated in the brain, spread over a wide area by the production of a vacuum, a phenomenon called cavitation. When you hit that wall and your brain keeps moving forward, there is a vacancy that occurs in the back of the head. As the brain moves forward, you suddenly have a vacuum behind the brain. And this vacuum generates a kind of reverse bubble. This is called cavitation. These bubbles form, but they're weak, and so they collapse quite quickly. And they collapse in a specific way. One end will start to collapse, and it wants to go all the way across the center of the bubble. So there's a period of time where you actually have a torus or a donut shape. And then when the collapse hits the opposite side, it pops the bubble. And that pop causes a microscopic explosive force to be spread about the brain. And the thing about it is, there's a broad area of vacuum. So there's a broad area of microscopic injury or submicroscopic injury, really, that causes damage. And if you think about it, one of the things about a head injury is seeing stars, right? Well, what you're seeing is the immediate disruption of function in the visual cortex, which happens to be in the back of the brain, related to this cavitation syndrome. If you see stars, you've had a traumatic brain injury, and you potentially, over time, will get worse. Now, we now know that once you've got that injury, you've got inflammation in the brain, and it takes a while for that to dissipate. And if you get a second injury while you've still got inflammation, you don't get twice the inflammation. You get 7, 10, 20 times the inflammation, and therefore 7, 10, 20 times the scarring and 20 times the damage and persistence of brain malfunction, which is what we see when people have a series of head injuries. Now, I'm thinking about all of the people who had traumatic brain injuries in this interminable war that we've been in the Middle East. I think about all the football players who probably started out with a few traumatic injuries, and I wonder what the brains of these veterans are going to look like in 30 or 40 years, because this damage happens on day one, but it doesn't become visible for years, 5, 10, 50, depends on when you look. And what we see is we see a lot of tau protein in these areas of scar. The brain shrinks. It also lights up with a particular protein, a protein, I might add, that is associated with Alzheimer's disease and is one of the main things that you look for in Alzheimer's disease after the fact. So this all sounds pretty grim, but there may be new ways to prevent the long-term effects of traumatic brain injury. So this is an article from September 9th. It is coming out of the Science Daily, and I'm going to just read segments of it. You've been in a car accident and sustained a head injury. You recovered, but years later, you begin having difficulty sleeping. You also become very sensitive to noise and bright lights and find it hard to carry out your daily activities or perform well at your job. And this is a common situation after traumatic brain injury. Many people experience bad side effects months or years later. And these long-term effects can last a few days, probably a second inflammatory burst, in my opinion, or the rest of a person's life. In a new study published in the journal Science, Jean Paz, the associated investigator at Gladstone Industries, and her team have helped close that gap. They identified a special molecule in the part of the brain called the thalamus that plays a key role in the secondary effects of brain injury, such as sleep disruption, epileptic activity, and inflammation. And working with a clinical stage biopharmacy company called Annexon Biosciences, they showed that an antibody treatment could prevent the development of these negative outcomes. Now, this makes sense. We know about the traumatic brain injury. We know about epilepsy. Did you know that 69 million people in the world have this, and it's the leading cause of death in children throughout the world, which surprises me. I would have thought it was infectious disease, but apparently it's getting head injury. So Paz and her team recorded the activity of different cells and circuits in the brain of mice after creating brain injury. They monitored the mice wirelessly, and they collected a lot of data. It was so much data, in fact, it crashed their computers. But they were looking at sleep and wakefulness, trying to get the whole picture. As I mentioned earlier, the cerebral cortex, often the back of the brain, is where we see the primary site of injury. But at later time points, the thalamus becomes even more disrupted. It develops high levels of a molecule called C1q. That was present in the initial injury in all of the tissues, but seems to accumulate in the thalamus. And these high C1Q levels are associated with inflammation and the death of neurons. And it seems like the thalamus might be particularly vulnerable to this. This is one of the long-term effects of symptomatic brain injury. What is C1Q? It's part of the immune pathway. It's been documented to have important roles in brain development and normal brain functions, and it protects the central nervous system from infection, and it helps you forget, which is really important in being able to remember. You got to clear out the closet before you can put more stuff in it. So it's good and it's bad. What Paz and her group wanted to do was see if they could leverage the latent phase after a traumatic brain injury in which the changes have occurred. There's been recovery. The late impacts haven't begun. So they reached out and produced a clinical antibody that could block the activity of this molecule. And they found that if they selectively blocked C1q with the antibody during the latent phase, they prevented the chronic inflammation. So they were able to turn off this chronic inflammation. So another interesting thing about this study, because they were monitoring the mice 24/7, they also discovered abnormal brain activity in the mice with the traumatic brain injury. So first they noticed that the sleep spindles, which are normal little brain rhythms occurring during sleep, were disrupted. And they also found epileptic spikes. And of course, these can be very disruptive to cognition and normal behavior. Even if they don't move on to a full seizure, they're like trying to watch a TV program back in the day when it was broadcast and there would be all this static when the next door neighbor turned on his power saw. That kind of interference, if you can visualize it, or jamming of a radio frequency, if you did the antibody treatment, you got the sleep spindles back and you prevented the development of the epilepsy. So this is really promising. There are other things that has been tried on. Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a autoimmune disorder which attacks the motor neurons, usually virally induced, but it can be produced by vaccines. There was a swine flu vaccine back in the 70s that for some reason was especially good at causing this autoimmune condition. And I actually have seen a case of Guillain-Barré that led to quite severe paralysis and eventually put the patient on a vent. It's one of the more extreme cases that even my attendings had seen. They've already used this drug in humans. They pretty much think that they can extrapolate its use in people with this autoimmune disorder and figure out how to use it after severe head trauma. This has not so long a way to go to becoming an actual accepted therapy. It is effectively an anti-inflammatory therapy targeted at the most vulnerable structures of the brain and validated as having benefit in inflammatory disorders of the brain in humans. So it makes a lot of sense to try and see this come on board sooner rather than later. And as promised, we're going to move now to some emails. We'll start with one from Brad from somewhere. In your September 22nd podcast, you pushed back on people who criticized the NIH FDA for changing positions. Personally, I think the bigger issue, and one that is valid to criticize, are the judgments, decisions, and communication by the NIH, FDA, and CDC that sometimes misrepresent or fail to acknowledge the scientific understanding or lack thereof. Examples include telling people not to wear masks for false reasons, parentheses, they won't help versus we need them for healthcare workers, forcing healthcare organizations to use slow and faulty CDC testing for COVID-19, initially claiming we could reach herd immunity via vaccines without understanding the nature of the virus. Now they say we may live with it forever, but vaccinations prevent serious illness. I think these unnecessary missteps and more are responsible for much of the distrust and criticism. In my humble opinion, these issues transcend the election, so it is not just the administration putting its thumb on the scale. FYI, I thought this podcast with Kelsey Piper of Vox made a good case for what the FDA and CDC do well and do poorly. The discussion starts 29 minutes in. So thank you, Brad, and I did listen to the relevant section of the podcast. He is a science writer for Vox, and she knows something about science. I did not read the part where we got her bona fides, but I'm going to take her as a credible source. But I first of all want to say that we didn't understand that we couldn't get herd immunity. I think that was probably actually a goal, because we do have herd immunity for measles, which is a similar kind of virus. So I think that was one of the cases where people honestly didn't understand the virus, its transmissibility, lots of facts that we didn't have when they were making that statement about trying to get to herd immunity. Then, of course, the politicians got a hold of herd immunity because that was a soundbite. And they rode that horse well past its use-by date. I'll agree with you there. But I think maybe the NIH and the FDA have to be conceived of as having two levels of performance. The first level being the scientific level, which I would argue has done a very good job of telling what we know and don't know and revealing and providing us truthful information. But it's just complicated and hard to reduce to a soundbite. And yes, indeed, at the top, the political appointees who run these agencies are trying to carry political water, and they are soundbiting. It's very true. But I want to ask you, before we start talking about the reason they made a decision, like the mask issue, for example, has the American people actually done anything lately to deserve being considered rational, considerate? Have we done anything lately, like in the last, 4 years, would lead our leaders to actually trust us to not be insanely selfish? We have, for example, the hoarding toilet paper and the hoarding hand sanitizer. And by the time I got back to the United States on March 10th, there was a ton of internet profiteering where people had just bought up all of the PPE and bought up all of the hand sanitizers they could find and were selling stuff at 1,000% markups. Was pretty routine. So yeah, there are people who will be defectors a la Prisoner's Dilemma, and they're out there, and maybe we don't need to give them ideas. Maybe that was part of the decision to underplay the importance of mask. I don't know, but I wouldn't blame them. Also, I do want to point out that, you know, we're talking about utilitarianism here versus humanitarianism. I get to be a doctor. I'm not a public health official. I'm not in leadership. And one of the reasons I'm not in leadership is that I'm too much of a humanitarian. I'm going to do whatever I can do for the person that's in front of me. And I've known that about myself for a very long time. So I don't belong making resource distribution and the kind of Solomonic decision of, do we cut the baby in half? Do we make that bluff? Yeah, I'm not that girl. But if you're going to be leading a nation, you have to be a utilitarian. It's really hard, this dynamic between doing what's best for society and what's doing best for the individual in front of you. And I would urge you to read about the early days of dialysis. It's in any bioethics textbook, and it really lays out the problem of how do you deny people scarce resources when they're going to die without them, but at the same time, if you don't deny them, then more people will die, or people who are debatably better for society to have survive, or maybe they haven't lived as long, and so it's mothers and children first, or is it? Or is it mothers and children second and corporate CEOs first? You know, think Titanic. So the incentives and needs of the FDA, the federal government, or the NIH are not necessarily equivalent to your needs. And like I said, even if you say, well, I want to be trusted as an adult, there's look to your right, look to your left, and you're probably looking at someone who shouldn't be trusted to be an adult. So maybe the government is actually asking, what can we say that will lead to the fewest deaths? I'll give them a pass on downplaying the masks, and obviously I'm a healthcare worker, so I thought it was important that we not lose our doctor resource or our nurse resource, because then everybody with anything dies, not just the COVID patients, but the guy with the heart attack and the guy with the car crash who needs prompt trauma center stabilization. And a lot of people did die. They call it excess mortality in epidemiology because they couldn't get a bed or they couldn't get past an ER that was full of people who were suffocating. If those healthcare providers die, if those cops don't show up for work, even worse things happen. We saw that during the 1918 flu epidemic, by the way, and that is one of the reasons I think that they had this plan in place. The other thing that was talked about in the podcast that I thought was a little interesting was this idea that maybe fluvoxamine, which is an anti depressant that really never got much traction because it was late to the table, and it actually works for OCD a bit better than it does for depression, may have benefit in COVID and could eventually start to be useful. Now, answering some of Brad's other points, forcing healthcare organizations to slow down to use slow and faulty CDC testing for COVID-19, no question. The fact that the CDC did not have a good functional test for COVID-19 early and decided at that point not to bag that concept and buy out whoever was selling, because at least their test worked sort of. Well, that was chauvinism and false economy. But I'd love to ask what other options were out there. I know that Europe had a better test. I think the World Health Organization had a functional test, but I'm not really sure how available it was. And I never heard anything one way or another about if they, you know, released the recipe. Now, this was a big error. The Abbott COVID antigen testing was not adopted when it first became available 18 months ago. It was shelved. The government decided not to buy it, and instead Abbott had to bring it through the slow track, and it came onto the market maybe 4 or 5 months ago, much later than it should have. And that was because the government was being advised by epidemiologists, of which Fauci is one. Epidemiologists are not clinicians. Epidemiologists are interested in counting the bodies and contact tracing and understanding the dynamics of how this pandemic is spreading in the population. This is all very, very useful stuff, but they're not clinicians. Clinicians are interested in self-protection and patient triage. Essentially, can I put this guy in general population because he's testing negative for infectious levels of virus? Or do I need to isolate him? Because isolation uses a lot of resources, which we are in short supply of at the moment. That's why there were all these beds in tents, right? That's why when we had our evacuation in August of 2020 here in Santa Cruz, I was out there being a doctor at the evacuation centers, and we had people in pup tents in gymnasiums because that was the best isolation we could manage. And we figured, well, their mask will fall off when they're asleep, but the pup tent will produce social distancing and probably catch most of the virus because it's all about concentration, right? We know that now. So the epidemiologists are asking, does this person have COVID? We don't want to miss a case of COVID. So they wanted that test. The clinicians are asking, is this person contagious right now? Both PCR and antigen testing are negative till you get to a certain threshold, but here's where they diverge. PCR stays positive a long time post-infectiousness. Antigen just doesn't stay positive. Once you're no longer infectious, you've dropped below the threshold. Even if there's still viral DNA in there, it's not enough to register as positive. So the PCR is more sensitive, but it's also more misleading. So we're going from saving lives versus tracking the magnitude. And that's a really different thing. A complicated answer, but I think one that covers a lot of your points. And I wish that you were on the phone right now so that we could continue the discussion, but feel free to send another email and address my points, or maybe even call in. If you are listening real time, you can call 831-900-5773. I'd love to hear what you have to say in response to that. So now we're going to respond to Dan in Ohio writes, FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P, folks, who haven't heard of it. My wife, Kathy, with a C, has had longstanding issues with her stomach, IBS and the like. They've gotten worse now that she's turned 70. Her stomach doctor recommended trying a FODMAP diet. It's hard to figure out what is good for this diet and what isn't. It turns out what I thought was good and bad completely on its head. It takes a lot of research, which we're willing to do. So far, in just a few days, there's been little change, but we're going to give it a thorough testing. There's info all over the internet, which is helpful. For those of us who've never heard of this previously, can you comment? Love your show, and I download it off of the internet. I also loved Dr. Dean and hope that I will be hearing your show for a long time. We've been vaccinated for COVID and believe in science. Thank you, too, for your strong stand there. Well, thank you, Dan. And let's talk FODMAPs. So what exactly are we talking about? FODMAPs are a subset of carbohydrates. I think that's the first thing to understand about them. And there's a bunch of different compounds that are technically FODMAPs. There's fructose, which you've all heard of, fruits, honey, high fructose corn syrup. There's lactose, which is dairy. There's fructans, and these are found in wheat, onions, garlic. And you may have heard me recommend fructans in the form of inulin. In fact, when I have people whose microbiomes are out of whack, I give them fructans because I want to feed the bifidobacterium and the lactobacillus, and they just love them, their fructans. Then there are galactans. This is a different six-carbon sugar called a galactose, and that's found in abundance in beans, lentils, legumes such as soy. And then there's a whole bunch of sweeteners called polyols, and you also find them in avocados, apricots, nectarines, basically all the plum fruits, fruits with a pit, sometimes called stone fruits, elaborate polyols, which is interesting. Xylitol, you'll probably have heard of. Erythritol, you may have seen combined with monk's fruit. You can buy these as artificial sweeteners. They are, quote-unquote, sugar alcohols. They're metabolized differently, so they don't raise blood sugar. They don't get turned into glucose. And all of the FODMAPs basically have two problems, one of which is they pull water into the intestine. And if you don't have the right enzymes to break them down, or you have a whole lot of bacteria in your small intestine, then your IBS will definitely be better if you go off FODMAPs. If your IBS is due to another problem, let's say you have antibodies against certain foods, that would be the case for someone with non-celiac wheat sensitivity. There are also other types of issues that are IBS-like. The problem is IBS is a syndrome, and syndromes generally have multiple causes. But it's useful to use the FODMAP diet if you think a person might have intestinal overgrowth syndrome, which is the main place where it's useful. All of us will have certain bacteria in our intestines that will be avid for certain things. If you don't eat galactans very often, those are the beans, lentils, and legumes, you're probably, if you eat a big meal of them, going to have a lot of farting because you don't make the enzymes to break them down. But if you eat them three or four times a week on a regular basis, your body will say, oh, this is now food. I'll make some of these enzymes that I wasn't bothering to make because I wasn't using them. I'll sharpen my tools and now I'll be able to break down those beans. So when you look at diets, you're basically trying to look at foods that are low in all of these compounds. I think the best one for you in terms of just telling you what to eat, what not to eat, is actually the Stanford University Hospital and Clinics. They have a digestive health center. If you Google something like Stanford and the low FODMAP diet, it'll pop right up. It explains it. It also gives you tips for how to do this. There are a lot of other things online, but this is the one that I've found to be most user-friendly, and so I hope you will as well. We're going now to a caller, and that is Chris from Santa Cruz. Hello, Chris.
Hi. Hello, Dr. Don. Good evening to you. Wonderful, you know, late summer, or early fall, right? What do you call it, Indian summer?
Wonderful. Oh, it's a beautiful day. Beautiful.
Hey, listen. So here, yeah, it was. And so on the heels of a great day, have a great question, and it's right in line with what you're talking about at the beginning of the show. Question is, the mouthwash issue and blood pressure kind of thing, you made that connection. What about if one rinses with, like, hydrogen peroxide? Is that the same issue? If you just go, like, you know, 3% hydrogen peroxide, does that have the same effect or not?
No, it would. It'll do the same thing. It's going to reduce the bacteria count. We used to think that was good before we understood that everything has a microbiome. So, yeah, it's probably a negative if you have high blood pressure.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, you could just eat large quantities of foods that have nitrite and nitrate in it, because as I mentioned, as long as you're not taking a proton pump inhibitor, you're going to get some conversion just on the basis of stomach acid. Also, chewing your food better gives the remaining bacteria a better opportunity. So don't gobble. I think I said that already once on this show, but it bears repeating.
Oh, I gobble and gobble all the time.
Well, don't. Stop your gobbling. Savor your
on Thanksgiving, the gobble gobble.
Just gobble slowly. How about that?
Can we
do like a leisurely slow dance gobble rather than the fast and frisky one?
Well, yeah, not sure, but no. So, anyways, okay. So your point is really, but if you don't have any of those negative indications with your health, that's already there. Is it still like okay? You could do it once in a while if you needed to or something, or you still recommend?
Oh yeah, it's sort of like taking antibiotics. There's a lot of resilience to the microbiome. So if I have somebody who gets yeast infections in her vagina when she takes antibiotics, I'm going to give her extra probiotics while she's on antibiotics because I don't want to kill off everything that's in there protecting her from the yeast, which is why she's getting the infections. The yeast is like an opportunistic organism. It's being kept it's being kept at bay by the acid produced by the bacteria. You kill the bacteria, the acid drops, and the yeast is suddenly very happy, and the patient is not. So it'll rebound. But it's those people who do it every day, you know, as part of their regular thing. And I figure that probably represents a fair number of older individuals who are at higher risk for that in the first place. They're at higher risk for hypertension. And we're always trying for the natural stuff, right? Eat the high nitrate foods. Don't use mouthwash. You can use toothpaste.
Toothpaste?
Yeah, toothpaste is fine.
Foam up your toothpaste and just kind of rinse with that. Okay.
Yeah. Chlorophyll drops and put them in water. That has a nice fresh taste, and swirl that around and that won't kill any bugs.
Okay. I appreciate your kind of clarifying that a little bit, always, you know. So, all right. Well, I'll let you get on to other callers if you have any with the rest of your show, but we appreciate your input always. We listen to you religiously.
Oh,
like
cool.
Going to church.
Oh,
Dr. Don.
Well, thank you. Have a great evening, and take good care of that little one I hear in the background.
Yeah, she's a little 16 month old, just getting into high gear here. It's like a full time job, you know.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. But that's why they're so cute, you know.
Yeah, this is why they're cute. But it's boy, like man, you can't put your guard down for 2 seconds.
Nope.
It's amazing.
Nope, you sure can.
She's climbing the stairs now. She's crawling up the stairs like a rocket. It's like, whoa, okay, don't try going down the stairs. She kind of has that one figured out, but still, yeah.
Eventually, she'll try doing it upright, so be ready.
Yeah, be ready, exactly, right. She's doing the crawl right now, but she's walking she's running like a sprinter these days. It's kind of funny. Anyways, all right, we enjoy it. Hey, thanks for your show. We appreciate your just lovely input on the world, you know, in the medical field and all that.
Thank you very much. You stay well. Take good care.
Thank you. Yeah.
Bye. I'm going to continue the dialogue with Tim in Funk, Nebraska, just because I am. I think that keeping the dialogue going when you don't agree with people, and that's what we want to be doing. We want to be talking to each other. So Tim wrote, this is the guy who didn't like your previous answer about ivermectin. Interesting things are starting to come out, and he gave me a link to a joannenova.com Australia. Anyway, it's joannenova.com. It's a podcast, I guess. And I did read it. This was one that was making arguments about the virus, COVID virus, that it was, you know, created in a lab. That's basically, this is the created in a lab meme and a bunch of reasons why that was right. But the main thing I wanted to address here was the sort of basic premise here. And I did go back to February of 2020 and look at what she was blogging then. I will give it to her. She was at least consistent because in early February 2020, she was calling for a global shutdown right away, pronto, for everything. Shut it down. We've got a massive pandemic on our hands. And yes, she was right. As far as the basic premise of her blog, it was, well, if we'd known that it was a genetically manipulated virus, we would have shut down faster. And I disagree with that. I think that things didn't shut down slower because this was a natural virus that was killing hordes of people. sorry, but I don't think that is true. I believe that corporate interests win over existential crisis every time. See global warming. As far as the idea that this was genetically manipulated, the first thing I would say is, so what if it was? How does that affect anything? We can see that it's very contagious and we can see that people are dying. What does it matter whether it's a natural mutation or a genetic manipulation? It was clearly not a deliberate release because it took down an entire Chinese city. So if they made it in a lab, they screwed up. And the end result is the same whether it's natural or a lab screw up, as far as that goes. If they had wanted to release this as a weapon, it would have showed up in 12 or 14 or 35 major airplane hub cities simultaneously. That's how that would look. So, yeah, not true. Also, as far as genetic manipulation is concerned, we here in the United States and a few places in the world, but mostly here, we invented this technology. All right. We know what genetic manipulation looks like. It leaves a tamper fingerprint that to a person who is, you know, walking in those weeds, they can see whether there's been genetic manipulation, and it isn't present in the base code. So what I want to talk about as a public health issue here is, you know, the green infrastructure thing, Tim, I want to spin this for you, okay? I think we can both agree that corporate interests win over the public welfare every time. And we got plenty of examples of corporations stalling and not wanting to admit things because it's going to affect their bottom line. So the only way that we are going to survive as a planet is this green infrastructure, this Green New Deal. We're going to have to bribe the corporate interests with money to get really, really interested in climate defense. We're going to have to throw lots of money at this anyway. A lot of it will go to Evil Corp, and I don't care because I just want to be able to walk on my beach and know that the Hawaiian Islands aren't submerged and that Europe isn't sitting under an ice cap because the Gulf Stream has disappeared. I don't want the massive storms. I don't want that for our children and their children. So, yeah, we got to pay the bill now, and if that means bribing the corporations to fix the problem, then let's do what we did with COVID-19, which was effectively bribe the corporations to fix the problem, bribe them to direct their massive resources where we want them to go. You have to create a market for these people. Markets are all they understand. Well, let's create that market. Let's create it now. Let's create lots of it. And let's invent our way out of this as quickly as possible. That's the biggest public health issue of the century. And we've gotten a little tiny taste of it here in Santa Cruz with the evacuations and some of the other fun things that have happened, like COVID. So, yeah, we need to do this. Well, we've got about a minute, and I'm going to switch gears. Let's talk about a study. It's not 10,000 steps. It turns out that it starts at 7,000. This is based on a study that was begun in 2005. They had 2,000 people, 38 to 50, wearing a device. And then they looked 11 years later. They saw what they died of. And they found that people who lagged at least 7,000 steps a day had a 50 to 70% lower risk of premature death than those who took fewer than 7,000. And the greatest reduction in mortality came between 7,000 and 10,000. So going above 10,000, it's diminishing returns. And if you can just get up to 7,000, you've gotten the bulk of the benefit. And you know what that is? That's doable, okay? That's 20-minute fast walk along with taking the stairs and parking on the far side of the parking lot. Little baby steps. And I know you can do it. And there'll be plenty of payoff, so it's worth doing. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.